welcome to Creative Psychopaths, a horror movie podcast and the world's premier kitchen for horror sandwiches. What are horror sandwiches, I hear you ask? Well, it's a lovely movie filling surrounded by two slices of chatty goodness. My name's Mark, and as always, I'm joined by Matthew. Hello.
Howdy.
How are you this week?
I'm living the dream.
Living the dream.
I'm actually excited this week. Well, sound like I'm not excited usually, don't it? No, I'm more excited than usual this week.
More excited than usual, wow.
Just because of what we're covering. I'm excited. It's going to be good.
Yeah, me too. And even more exciting, this week we're joined by another guest. I think this is 3 weeks in a row we've guested, so that's fantastic. And we're joined by the reviewing Rodders himself, James. Hello.
Hi there, guys. Thanks for having me on.
And how are you?
Thanks for coming.
How are you? Yeah,
I'm doing well, thanks. I mean, the weather's, well, it's not great, but it's been much better than it's been as of late. So everything's coming up, Millhouse.
Oh, you found a home here with the Simpsons reference. Yeah,
beautiful.
I've been dealing this week with a tooth infection, and toothache is as bad as everybody says it is.
Fucking sucks.
Yeah, it's awful. And I'm not good with my teeth anyway. I don't like the dentist. So, and of course, I had to go.
I thought you were going to say you don't brush then.
I just don't like the dentist. And then I went and they went, oh, you've got an infection in your teeth. Take these antibiotics and come back later for a root canal. So that'll be fun.
The last time I had a tooth infection, the dentist literally said to me, it's like, right, you're going to need a crown for this tooth. And it's like £300. Or I could just take it out and it's like gone 50 or whatever it were. Like, they really have got the pricing structure all wrong there, haven't they? Not really encouraging people to have good teeth.
No.
It's much cheaper to just rot them out and get, dentures in. I think dentures are only like 250 or something.
Did you go for the cheaper option? Did you get arrived out?
No, I got the crown.
There was one point last year where I had
flash bastard.
Go on, James.
There was a point last year where I had to go to the dentist and I was having some tooth pain and they had to like put me under sedation and drill at it while I was awake and all I could think of in my drug haze while that barbarity was happening was the Steve Martin song from Little Shop of Horrors when he's being a brutal dentist, which... Yeah. Funny enough, put me at ease, actually. But
oh dear. Yeah, no, it's...
Fun fact, in the original, that was one of Jack Nicholson's first film roles.
Oh.
He was the sadist, the masochist that loved the pain.
Oh, of course, yeah, in the black and white one. Yeah.
The old Roger Corman one.
Oh, yeah. Well, there you go, you see. Wow.
But the worst experience I've ever had at the dentist, when I was at uni, I took a cricket ball to the face and it basically broke up like the back four of my teeth and the upper left side. And I found out that when your back teeth get break, they don't just like fly out of the root like you imagine. They break and crumble. And then all the roots were left in. So I had to go to the dentist and then they just injected them up and then stuck a big metal thing in each of the roots just to break what was left in there and then pick out all the pieces with some tweezers.
Yeah. Oh, God.
That was horrible.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I know this is a horror podcast, but geez Louise, we don't need that in our lives. Yeah.
And I was wearing a helmet when I was playing as well, which made it even worse.
But it could have been worse then, you know? So actually,
Well, yeah, because I have a massive head, so the like the grill on the helmet was too close to my face essentially, and it the ball hit the helmet, and the helmet just carried on into my mush.
Yeah. Well, I suppose that's what you get for having a massive head.
Yeah, bigger target.
Yeah, bigger target. Stupid helmet. I don't really know how that works. Well, lovely. Oh, well, you see, a little bit of Dennis chat before you know it, you're relaxed and ready to ask questions. So, James, are you ready to be grilled with us about what you horror stuff? It's not really a word, is it?
Yeah.
This first
Yeah,
slice of
grill me
bread.
like I'm a burger.
Yeah, well, it is sandwich related, lovely. Although this is the bread, so we'll consider it as a toasting.
Toast me then.
toast me up. So sort of tried to combine these first two together. So is what was the first horror movie you remember seeing, and when did you become a horror fan?
So the first horror movie I remember seeing, I remember it happened, I would have been about 7 years old, and it was during a school break. I believe it was more autumn break, like when it's closer to Halloween. And I just remember it was late one night. My parents had went to sleep and I was just there awake, so I thought, I'll sneak downstairs, let's see what's on TV. And so I turned on to, I believe it was Channel 5, expecting to see some Bruce Willis film that was on the listings or something. I neglected to realize that the time for that film would have finished earlier than when I came down. So I was a bit surprised when I turned on the TV to Nightmare on Elm Street 3 Dream Warriors, in particular, the scene when Freddy Krueger's puppeteering a teen through his veins. That
Wow.
was quite the. F Yeah, quite the thing to just suddenly see. And I just remember changing the channel because it was just like, what the hell was that? And just trying to watch something else. But it awakened something in me. There was a curiosity about what I'd just seen. So after a little bit, I just thought, let's go finish it. I changed the channel back, and it was at the point where Freddy's coming out the TV and just going, welcome to prime time, bitch. And I was just like, yeah, let's just watch this unfold and see what happens. Yeah, that was a bit formulative for me, I guess.
Yeah, I mean that's how that's a good
It's a
that's a good
really good
place to
first.
start. Yeah.
Yeah. Surprising, like a lot of times when we get this question, people tend to say that they were a bit of a chicken when they first saw a horror film, and it wasn't until later that they, I don't know, I guess chasing that rush of being scared like that again. So I think this it's one of the rare occasions where someone's gone, oh yeah, I saw this really like gruesome horror film when I was seven, and then yeah, I thought it was rad. It's rare we get that.
Allow me to just follow that up with when I became a horror fan, because after that incident, I had a curiosity about horror, but at the same time, I just there was it just felt like a bit more of a leap to watch another horror film. So I didn't really watch like anything else for a while, but the internet was around, so I read articles about like Jason Voorhees' best kills, or I read Wikipedia summaries about what happened. And then as I grew into a teenager, I tried more and more films. Like Scream would come on the TV, Final Destinations, the early couple, and the Evil Dead films were ones which helped me transition more into a horror fan. And then it just came to a point, around the late 2000s, when I was watching reruns of Buffy and Angel on TV, I was reading The Walking Dead comics, I was watching whatever I could pick up from the bargain bin at Blockbuster. And I think it was just at that point when I was like, I think I do like horror.
I'm consuming horror media as much as I can. Yeah. I mean, I'm with you on the Angel and Buffy thing. I watched loads of that. I watched that the first time round. So, that's how sadly old I am. I don't know if that makes me old or not. I have no idea. It was the '90s.
Makes you an OG fan.
I was thinking, what was the sorts of things that you were able to get from those bargain bins? Like, was there any like weird obscure stuff that stuck with you that would be good to pick up now?
I mean, there was a curious mix of stuff. It was there was stuff which had come on cinemas, like there was a Dorian Gray film starring Ben Barnes, which did not hold up when I watched it later. But there was also stuff like Let the Right One In and Triangle, the Christopher Smith film, set on the boat. And I believe I saw Pontypool in there one time. And it was just quite a decent array, but it was getting through that with loads of copies of like stuff which belonged in the bargain bin, really. The stuff which doesn't sound like a real film, in honesty.
I think I spent too much time in those bins myself. But I don't think I was watching horror at those times. I was just watching whatever I could get my hands on. I miss those days, though. I do miss the days of walking around those shops, trying to figure out what I'm going to watch. I mean, I suppose it's essentially the same as being on Netflix, but, you know, you feel less judged. Mm.
Well, I used to work at a video library. It was my first job. And it was the best job in the world. But also what made it so great was why I lost the job. Because it was 2007, I want to say. And I used to work just on Sundays. And I would go in and it was 12 till 9. And there would be like 4 customers all day. And it was right around the corner from my house. So I would just watch movies all day. I'd take my Xbox and play it. At some point in the evening, my dad would come around and bring me food. And I would kill for that job now. Like, I would happily do that job, like, just as a part-time job on top of mine. Because that's, you know, if I'm lucky, how I get to spend my Sundays now. But then there were no customers, so the place shut down.
Yeah, I suppose it's 6 of one, half a dozen of the other, really, isn't it? Yeah. Still, nice job. I would have liked to have a job like that. I was wanting to work in a cinema, and I never did. But now I think about it, I don't think working in the Odeon is as glamorous as I'd like it to be.
No, I've got quite a few friends who all met working at the same cinema. And none of them look back on the actual cinema work particularly fondly.
That's a shame. I suppose you can go to like London and some of the big ones like the Prince Charles and stuff like that, where you really, it's probably a bit more of an experience. But yeah, not the big chain ones. What's sad times? All I really want to do is program movies. And in that, all I really want to do is watch the films I want to watch on the big screen. Jaws every week. So it's interesting you were saying about Nightmare on Elm Street 3, and it often comes up as one of our best kills. So might as well ask you now the question, what is your best kill?
So when you posed this question to me, I was tempted to go with American Psycho when Paul Allen gets the axe to the head. But I'll be honest, that's mainly just because I don't like Jared Leto.
Understandable.
So I went in a different direction, and I went for Frank's death in Hellraiser.
All right,
I think it's just part of it is you're seeing this absolute scumbag just get torn apart, but it's also you've got these killer effects in play, and it just feels so cathartic. And you also have just an absolutely brilliant line of Jesus wept. And I think it's just that perfect marriage which goes to make something which just sticks in the mind for a very good reason, really.
Yeah, yeah. I was watching Hellraiser the other night, put it on, and sorry, I'm deviating a bit from what you just said, but when I answered these questions with Matthew, I think I went for Frank rebuilding himself as like a special effect, just to be different from everyone else. And I was watching it back going, I'm so glad I chose that, because that movie's so it, that bit when he get where the blood drips and he just starts reforming is so good. But yeah, that so would that be the second time? Because you don't really see him go the first time, do you? Or do you? I can't remember.
I think you just see like little bits of him in the aftermath, but
yeah,
I think that's the first time we've seen him torn apart like he's a wishbone or something.
Yeah, it's a pretty gross death. I don't think Hellraiser ever really did anything better than that in terms of, you know, the deaths, but yeah, those chains suck. I don't think I'd fancy that death.
No, that seems like a really, I mean, none of the deaths seem like they're a good way to go, but the chains just seem like a really painful way to.
They look sore, don't they?
Yeah, they look dreadful.
Yeah, I don't find no chains in my flesh, please. I don't want my soul tearing apart. So let's see. Well, I just said it. So, what are your favourites or standout effects from a horror?
I think my answer is going to be that probably a lot of people said, but I think for good reason, because essentially the one answer I had was just John Carpenter's The Thing, and especially the whole defibrillator sequence in that film.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, we have right answers on here. The Thing is one of the right answers for this question. So well done, you've got the correct answer.
Ding, ding, ding.
But the thing is, you say it because it's right. It's just correct. Those are some of the greatest special effects from a horror movie. And the fact of the matter is, they hold up today, don't they? Really?
Absolutely.
No, I think that's got to be the mark of it, really.
I think we are running out of things that we can say, are we, about it? Because it's come up that, you know, it's come up so many because it is so good.
It's about time we covered it.
Yeah, I was thinking it's about time we covered Hellraiser because that seems to keep cropping up at the minute.
Yeah.
Maybe they can be our next two.
Oh, that's exciting. Oh, Hellraiser.
That'd be a double bill.
And The Thing. Wouldn't it? Wouldn't it be good? I've also got Silent Hill in the line. A few people have wanted that, and someone's come to me and asked to do it. So that's also in the line. So I remember liking Silent Hill. Lovely. Let's see. So, do you have a favorite horror movie franchise?
I think I'd have to go with The Evil Dead, because there's a lot of horror movies which I love them, but the franchise itself is just no. But The Evil Dead is one of the better franchises, and part of that is down to how the series is just seems so gleeful at, like the Deadites, about how just cruel it can get and how fantastic it can go with the practical effects, especially. And I too quite like not just Sam Raimi's films, but also Fede Alvarez and Lee Cronin, what they've added to the franchise, and I did quite like Ash vs. Evil Dead when it came out. And I will also say that I have a soft spot for A Nightmare on Elm Street, despite not a home run of a series, I guess. But I think with Nightmare on Elm Street, when it's good, it can be really good. So that makes me endear towards it.
Yeah, let's see. Well, we're not long just finished. Well, I say not long. Last September, we finished watching all the original Nightmare on Elm Street, so we're pretty familiar with those. And I'd agree with you. When it's good, it's good. And actually, they're relatively consistent. I mean, the main problem with those movies is they lose a bit of setup of characters, and they become a bit samey. But but that wasn't your answer, was it? Was he Evil Dead? Which do you know what? I can't argue with you. I think that, you know, we often say Scream, but I think Evil Dead might be the most consistent franchise. There's not a bad one, is there, really?
Over the course of our podcast run as a duo, I have changed my mind from saying Scream, my first appearance, to Evil Dead. Just there isn't a weak entry.
No.
You know,
I'd agree.
There are some that aren't as good as others, but they are all good. You know, it's a franchise that gives so much variety as well. You know, when we were talking about Evil Dead last year on the bonus episode, and we were just thinking, like, what do we want next? Do we want funny Evil Dead? Do we want scary Evil Dead? do we want some sort of, you know, middle ground? Because it's gone all those different ways, and it's been effective every time it's tried to do whichever of those directions it's taken.
Mm-hmm. I think it also helps that it feels like whoever's directing it, they can do whatever they want with it. It's not like they've got to fit into a specific box. It feels like they can make their own stamp on the franchise, and it'll slot in quite well.
Yeah, you're right. They don't appear to be precious about it. You know, I think it's as long as you read the book and that's it, really, isn't it? As long as the book gets read, do what you want with it from there. Because I mean, I've watched Evil Dead Rise a couple of times now, and you know, I think it's really good. I mean, obviously I've seen all the others, but yeah, I don't think I can argue with you on that one. Not that I was going to. It might even be the right answer, you know, because what else is most consistent?
I mean, outside of Evil Dead and Scream, I'd probably say maybe Chucky or Final Destination, but even then, there are some lesser entries in the series.
Why not?
I would probably argue as well that those films haven't started with the real bona fide classic that Evil Dead has and Scream has and Nightmare on Elm Street has. You know, because I think that's, when you look back at franchises, that's pretty much how they normally go, don't they? How there's one groundbreaking film to kick off with, and then sequels of varying quality afterwards. As I'd say that Chucky, to a lesser extent, Final Destination doesn't really have that, does it? It's just a good, fun sort of update on the slasher, isn't it? Rather than something like brand new and exciting, like, you know, Halloween, for example.
Yeah,
I suppose.
Very true. Well, then, let's ask this question. What movie would you like to get a sequel from, or movies that you'd like to stop making sequels now?
Well, I couldn't think of a movie where I just want them to stop making sequels.
Oh, lovely.
I guess I'm an optimist in that way, hoping each sequel, maybe that'll be a decent one, but I don't know. In terms of movies that need a sequel, I really want a sequel to Malignant.
Yes, that's what I said.
I
Give
think
us
just
more.
yes. And to be honest, down the line, if you want to go do Malignant in space, please.
I like the way you think.
I
Yeah,
just
just go batshit with it. Let's do it.
exactly.
Think I haven't actually seen Malignant all the way through yet. And I think partly because it was very much spoiled for me,
Oh.
which and I think one of the main bonuses of that film is that it goes a bit batshit towards the end, and when it catches you off guard, it's like, oh, this is brilliant. So yeah, but I do really want to see it. And mind you, in terms of what you were saying before, I wouldn't worry. They're not going to stop making sequels anyway. So. We're sequel bound forever, I think. Although we haven't had a Jaws one in a while. Come on, whoever it is, Universal, pull your finger out. Or don't. Let's see.
Michael Caine needs another house. Come on.
Yeah, come on, Michael Caine needs another
Mm.
house. And I want more shark films, thank you. Not that there aren't a million different shark films. I mean, low budget shark films are everywhere. Everywhere you go. Every corner you turn, you find yourself faced with an asylum shark movie or something. Right,
Or the
so.
Meg.
Yeah, I quite liked The Meg 2. I thought it was pretty good fun. Yeah.
I never saw it. I like Ben Wheatley, so I have no excuse. But the Met first Meg film just was not it for me.
Yeah, I liked The Meg 2 because it knows what film it is. And
Okay.
for me, that's something that really fits. It's like when you watch Jason X. Yeah, it's Jason in space, but it knows it's Jason in space, so you can run with the fun of that. So yeah, no, that's what I liked about The Meg 2. It knows it's a dumb giant shark movie. And that's what you get. So yeah, good fun. Let's see. So what have we got left? I think it's just the scariest horror movie.
Right, so my answer is the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre film. I remember the first time I saw it, it would have been about a decade ago. I was helping my fiance dog sit for a godmother, I believe, and while she went to work and I was just there alone looking after the dog, and I just thought, I wonder what DVDs they've got. And just having a look to see, put something on, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre was there. I was just like, you know what? Why don't I just fill this blind spot? And I remember it was a pretty hot summer day, but just from early on, I was just shaking and shivering. It was just leaving me so unsettled. And then when the first kill came, the hammer kill, it just, like, it happened so quickly, and I was just there, like, in shock. It's just like, what the hell just happened? And I've seen this film a few more times. I went to the cinema twice to see it, and every time it's just left a considerable impact upon me. And I do think it's possibly the scariest film I've seen. Although Wreck, I would say, is a close second. That fucked me up as well.
Yeah, that's a scary one. But your Texas Chainsaw Massacre is fantastic. I saw that this year for its 50th anniversary, which and it was just so good. The cinema release was good anyway because they had instead of like regular trailers, whoever had released it cut in old school trailers. So there was like these old 70 schlocky trailers before it. And, you know, I wouldn't normally have my phone out in the thing, but I had my notes out on my phone going, do that, let's check that. I haven't got around to watching them, but they do look pretty gross and fun. So, yeah, there's one about like killer curtains or something. I think it's just called curtains.
Excuse me?
There have been over the years some really good films about killer pieces of clothes. There was one recently about a killer pair of jeans that I can't remember the name of.
Oh, slacks.
Is that what it was called?
Yes. XX at the end, spelled slack, for slacks. That was a great one.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. I mean, I can't imagine there are too many more. Yes, it was that, yeah, yeah. Really, it was actually really good, or at least, you know, like that. And there was Rubber recently, and it's like, which was about killer tire, and it's like, you know, these films are much better than they've got any right to be. But I really quite enjoyed Slacks. Yeah.
That Killer Curtains one, by any chance, was the tagline, "It's curtains for you"?
I don't know, but if it wasn't, it should have been.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Well, that brings us to the end of our first slice of bread, which means we're getting into the movie that you've that you brought for us. It's sorry, I got distracted there. Let me do this again. I was looking it up to see what the tag. No, it's Curtains, the Ultimate Nightmare. Not very good, is it?
Oh, that's boring.
Yeah.
I mean, Curtains for You is so obvious that I'm shocked that it didn't go through, frankly.
I wonder if it's a UK turn of phrase.
Or maybe.
Maybe.
No, it's from the theatre, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, of course. Well, I don't know then. Right, okay, let me try and... Right, anyway, so let's get into this film that you brought along now. It's much anticipated here. We've talked about it before, but never really talked about it properly. So Matthew's going to introduce us to the movie, and then you can tell us why he suggested it. So
yes, yeah. So it's one of the big ones, isn't it? One of my favorites, and thank you for bringing it to us. So we are talking Hereditary, and it was the from 2018, the feature debut from Ari Aster, and it has a cast of Toni Collette as Annie Graham, Alex Wolff as Peter Graham, Gabriel Byrne as Steve Graham, Millie Shapiro as Charlie Graham, and Anne Dowd as Joan, and then a full supporting cast as always. And for our plot, we have, when Ellen, the matriarch of the Graham family, passes away, her daughter's family begins to unravel cryptic and increasingly terrifying secrets about their ancestry. Not sure I like that as actually as a rundown, but that's what Letterboxd is saying. We'll get into why for that as we go, I'm sure. But yeah, James, why did you bring this to us?
So I was trying to think of horror films that I quite liked and something I wanted to bring, something that I wanted to chat about again. And I'll be honest, part of the reason I chose this film is because a couple of years back, my fiance got me this poster where it's 100 must-watch horror films, and with each one you watch, you scratch off a square and it reveals a little image in there. And I'd watch most of them, so I just endeavoured to make the most of it by re-watching the films I've already seen before scratching them off. And I looked on there to see what's there that I haven't scratched off yet, and Hereditary is on there, and I just... This was my favourite film of 2018, but at the same time, I haven't seen it since the cinema release because it really fucked me up in cinemas. And I think it was just pulling double duty for me choosing this, because I managed to scratch off one on the poster. So a bit of a selfish reason, but also it gave me the chance to finally pull the trigger and rewatch this film to see whether it was just the cinema experience, or if it truly is still as impactful. And yeah, it fucked me up in cinemas and it fucked me up at home. It's brilliant.
I have to admit, I think that's a lovely reason to have watched it again. Not for fucking you up, but to to get it off the poster. But I think that was a great idea. Give us some good ideas, actually, to think of films in the future. But I'm super glad that you brought this, because I love this one.
Yeah, so I mean, this is one that I've gone on about so much, and I think you've alluded to exactly why I've come back to it so much as a film that I love this, because we watch a lot of horror movies here, as you would, well, you'd hope, given that we talk about them a lot. And as a result, we don't get scared much because we're kind of desensitized to it. This film is still scary.
Yeah.
It throws me right back, you know, to being, you know, young and buying into these films and not, you know, having my calluses built up, because it works. It really gets me. And it's good to know that I'm not alone in that, frankly.
Yeah. The thing that this film actually does to me consistently, is it, there is, there's a couple of like tropes in it that it feels like are going to happen and doesn't happen. But I remember them happening, if you know what I mean. And, you know, this is completely spoilery. So, you know, I'll cut like very near the end of the film, when there's a body in the attic and she sends her husband up to check on it. Every time I think to myself, oh, it's not up there, but it is up there when he goes up there. And it's like, it's such a thing for it to never be there, if you know what I mean. So it being moved. And every time I think to myself, oh, it's not up there. And it is. It always catches me off guard, which is a bit of a weird thing, but I think that's probably one of the reasons that it manages to scare me most times, because it keeps catching me off guard.
I would go with another reason for me is that there is so much imagery in this that is so well executed and so powerful that it sticks with me. And I mean, if you're going to say this to most people, the obvious things would be the head.
Yep.
You know, and Charlie's death, which is, I mean, properly horrific still every time, just because of that, you know, you know it's going to happen, and that makes it worse in so many ways. But the one I always go back to is, again, spoilery, right at the end, is Toni Collette cutting her own head off with the piano wire, like while she's floating. And that, it properly like shocked and sickened me when I saw it in the cinema. And every single time it gets me, you know, it's so well executed. And yeah, the idea of it is disgusting, and just, yeah, but one of many bits in this film that I just think fucked. completely fucked.
Yeah. I mean, I have to admit that I had the same thought with this, that I thought when we did Candyman the other week, which was, I wonder what subgenre this fits under, because it feels like that one, it feels like it fits into a lot of different places. And I think it's potentially trying to do that, because it's got the ghost vibes on it, but it's also got big folk horror vibes as well. What do you get? What do you think?
Yeah, possession vibes as well.
Witch vibes. It's a witchy movie. It's like a secret witch movie.
Cult.
Yeah,
cult. Religious horror. It's all kind of in there.
Yeah, it's got a lot going on. I suppose, yeah, really getting to sort of, you know, going right back to the beginning, really. I mean, the great thing about this is it leads you down the road of Scary Child, doesn't it? And it holds your hand for that, and it's going, oh, Scary Child. And you go, oh, God, what's this Scary Child going to do? And then, you know, for those people who are, if you haven't seen it, you shouldn't be here. But, you know, the fact that, is it about 45 minutes in, Scary Child is gone, child? You suddenly, it puts you on edge anyway. And then, you know, it's, that brings upon the film a level of grief that you can't escape. Which is, you know, Toni Collette, you know, she should have got an Oscar for this, really. Because that, she sort of deals with two types of grief in this film, and that second type, that uncontrollable type, it's brutal to watch and really, really feeling, you know, it you'd have to be sort of dead inside to not really feel that grief coming through the screen. So we're all over the place with this one, aren't we? Talking about the whole thing, but it's just, I think it's just one of those movies that just, you want to talk about everything about it, but you don't know what to say. You don't know what to say. But yeah.
I think this is a film where watching it a second time or a third time, whatever, really adds to the experience, because you see the foreshadowing that's left throughout, and it really paints a tragic picture of this inescapable curse that's essentially, which is going to lead to this family just being absolutely destroyed in very horrific ways. But also, it's just, rewatching this, I don't think I've ever felt absolute dread from just seeing a telephone pole as this film gave me. And then there's the first moment where Charlie made that clucking noise. It just gave me PTSD to the first time I ever saw this film. And it's just really fascinating how it brought up these new feelings or these new layers of terror for me, despite me having already seen this film before.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was going to be what I was exactly thinking as well, in that this film, to me, gets better every time I watch it, which is obviously rare and hard for a film to do. But I remember at the time it was released, and I quite liked the way that it went in the end, and it was, you know, this cult of devil worshippers, which feels like a left turn when you watch it the first time. And then looking back, watching it again, you just realize this is the story. It's been there all along. None of this nothing that happens in the film is a surprise or a left turn. It just feels like that. You know, it's all built up. It's all seeded, and it progresses, you know, this way very, very deliberately. And to the point where like comments that get thrown away that you think are building up to this, you know, like character building scenes, like when Toni Collette first goes into the grief support group, and she says that her brother took his own life because he was saying that he had schizophrenia and he had different people in his body, and you think, oh, this is building up this tragic life that this woman's had, that we're sympathizing with her, and you go watch it the second time, you go, oh no, her brother did that because his mother was trying to put one of the kings of hell into his body and he couldn't handle that. And then at the end of the film, another person, you know, throws himself out of a window because the same thing's happening and he's terrified of it. And it's like the script that is doing one thing the first viewing is doing something. Well, it's doing the same thing, but doing this whole other thing on the second viewing. And the only film that I can think of that really did something as well as that, it was Get Out. And it's like there's not an ounce of fat on it. It's incredibly the way that it's put together for repeat viewings.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think we had the same thing with Midsommar, though, didn't we, when we watched that back? That's very much, I think, an Ari Aster style. I think he likes to he likes to foreshadow his own film, and it's delightful to rewatch it for that. It really is.
Absolutely.
Well, you say we spoke as well about Toni Collette winning, well, how she should have won awards for this, especially an Oscar. Can we talk also just very quickly about the dad of the piece? Because his performance was like really, really good in this time around, Gabriel Byrne. Like, what a job he's doing, just trying this put upon guy who's trying to hold his family together while all of this shit's going on around him, and he's, you know, constantly the voice of reason, and the whole film would fall apart if people just listened to him because he says the right thing all the time. But he's kind of, I don't know, duty to his family means that he's powerless to stop anything like this happening. Like, just like really great. Toni Collette should have won leading actress, and I think a support Oscar for Gabriel Byrne for this wouldn't have gone amiss.
I agree. It's funny, I watched it this time thinking to myself how his character never seems to be able to grab hold of his own grief. He's having to hold everyone together. I think the fact that they managed to portray that without even doing anything is really, really great. Yeah.
That whole just sort of sorrowful air he has around him, but he's parking it to look after his family. Like, he's such a sad character. The fact that he's, you know, by doing that, he's the one that's right all the time. the way that he's trying to hold on to what he has rather than chase after what he's lost. Obviously, it wouldn't make for a film if they did listen to him, but I think he was also the one that initiated no contact with, the grandmother for the first child. And again, if they'd have just kept it that way, there would have been none of this mess.
I suppose. Yeah, I suppose what you were saying, though, like, I mean, in terms of actors, because Alex Wolff is doing a great job too. I mean, it's acted fantastically across the way. you know, Millie Shapiro as Charlie, but apparently she's quite big on Broadway. She was definitely in Matilda, but yeah. She's done some of the other things as well. She's pretty. Yeah. I didn't know it. I really, really didn't know anything about it. I think this must have been her first feature film, but you know, in terms of
this is her only feature film.
Oh, is it?
Her only other screen acting credit is a short film from 2021 called Monkey Bars.
Oh, really? So it is.
Oh. Yeah, she's. I mean, what a career if she has just been this real weird girl in a movie, like horror icon, frankly, and then just never shows up again. Like, what a mark to leave.
Yeah, she was won a Tony, so yeah, good for her. shot fantastically as well, as movies go. The opening shot you get on the minis that goes into the actual room is just seamlessly superb, isn't it? Has a weird amount of dread about it. I suppose when you're watching a horror film, though, your hackles are already up, aren't they? So,
it's the way it moves so slowly while that score plays. It feels like someone's worked out the right combination to just make you feel dread, and it's. This alchemy somehow works, because just those opening shots, just slowly moving through the house, not a lot happening on screen, but I can just feel the hairs on the end of my arms just standing up on edge, because if something's coming and I'm not gonna feel comfortable.
Yeah. I mean, the whole the minis thing throughout it is, I think there's probably more to the minis than I've picked up. I mean, it does a good job, I think, of maybe telling a story that you haven't seen. You sort of vaguely hear Toni Collette at one point saying, you know, grandma wouldn't let me feed you, she wanted to feed you. But then when you see that depicted in mini form, it's like, oh, the actual breast, but then it's hard to say how that went.
Yeah, he does that thing that we're speaking about, doesn't it? That gives you the story. I mean, they're just ways of getting across exposition effectively and efficiently without having to have two characters talk to each other. You know, in a way that no human beings ever talk to each other normally, do they? So that, you know, they play out these scenes without, you know, without having to film them, without having to find a way to cut them in, and just to fill out the story. And it's, again, yeah, really good ways of doing that.
Yeah, and it also feels like, sorry.
You say I think they just feel just a bit creepy, don't they? Anyway, just by being little, and the subject matter of them as well.
Hmm. Yeah, and it also feels like it's a good way to get into the head of Annie. But it feels like she's struggling to deal with this, cope with her grief. So it's almost like the models are her outlet. It's like how we see her do that model of Charlie's death, and Stephen is understandably horrified, and her response is that it's a neutral vision of the accident, which is, it's really fascinating that she would depict that considering, but at the same time it feels like it says so much about her. But it also, this whole miniature stuff, the doll's house, it gives this creepy air of how it's like the characters are as it's as though they're in a dollhouse, that they're playthings for something that's out of their control, and they're just being toyed with for the amusement of others that they cannot comprehend until it's vastly too late.
Yeah, that goes back to the bit at the beginning as well, doesn't it? When they're talking about, I think it's Hercules and the teacher, and one of the students who both turn up in the scene at the end, are talking, discussing whether it's, you know, it's more sad if a person has free will or not when they're subject to these extraordinary events. And again, it's just the film going, yeah, we're going to do stuff to them, and they might have free will in this, they might not. and it, you know, when you say that how the playthings exemplified by these miniatures, it goes to this as well, doesn't it? And how they're all part of this huge plan by a hell cult.
Yeah. Let's see, what else have I got written down? Well, I want to talk a bit, obviously, about, you know, the sort of end of the movie, or at least some of the end of the movie. Well, as you've talked about, Toni Collette's character sort of saws her own head off, but before then, there is some excellent, really excellent scares in this with just lurking in the shadows. Well, not even really lurking in the shadows, almost lurking in plain sight of you, but not the character. Which are, you know, what I think is great in this movie is it feels like it's teasing you with jump scares that you never get. And you know that the whole movie has got, usually with a horror movie, you know, like jump scares and stuff like that gives you a bit of catharsis, doesn't it, for it. Whereas this does, it never does that. And I think even doing those bits, it just keeps ranking up the tension all the way through until, and to a degree, I think this is why the ending gets a bit of, but people are not a big fan of the ending of the movie, but I think it's because it never really gives you that actual release of finally being able to scream at the screen. It's good stuff in terms of that. And you know, one of the things I really like about the ending is, I don't necessarily like the naked people, but I think it's interesting to see them in the background because they're not part of the scenery really, and yet there they are. Especially the one dude who's got a real smirk on his face.
I think he was the guy who was at the funeral at the beginning.
He was at the funeral with a big smirk on his face,
yes,
wasn't he?
Yeah.
Smiling so much.
Yeah, he knows he's getting rich for bringing a king of hell to Earth.
Well, apparently, the new cultists, they were meant to be all dressed in red robes instead, and I don't know who made the change to make them all nudists, but it feels more effective for me to have them all just bare all, rather than, because the whole cult robes can feel a bit of a samey image. And considering this film did come out before the onslaught of scary nude people like X and Barbarian, and it does feel like this was I don't know if I'd say starting a trend, but it does feel like one of the instigators for what horror cinema would latch onto for their horror films.
And I think thematically as well, it works in the sense that this is the point where everything's, you know, we're made aware of everything, and everything is literally laid bare for us. So I think, you know, the actors are as well, just gives it an extra little, you know, bit of something. And I think there is a lot of nudity, but there is also, you know, some cover-ups as well. So I think it does feel that people that may not have been comfortable with it were also like, you know, it wasn't something that felt mandatory necessarily.
So the other thing I always find interesting about this film is the sort of the very end, or sort of the ending, as it were. And again, I think this comes back to what I was saying about a lack of, you know, it doesn't even give you a sort of what feels like a victory for the bad guy. Because even when we sort of finally focus in on the character having been finally possessed by Paimon, you still can't quite tell whether either it's worked or it's happy, or, you know, you don't get a fun smirk at the end, you know, to go, aha, I finally got what I want. It just, you're still left feeling like, you know, this was just horrible. This was just a horrible thing that happened, and I still don't even know whether it was, you know, even the demon was happy about it. I don't know. You know what I mean? And of course, then we get a cheery song.
Yeah, I really love the score for the end of it. It does those chimes and bells that makes you think like something like nice and magical's happened, when really it's a confused soul taking over a new body, and it's actually something that's going to spell trouble for a great many people, I would imagine.
Yeah. It's just, it's a very strange, isn't it, for it to, I don't know, like I say, with this film, it just doesn't, I think that's why it ends up making you feel really crappy, because it never really lets up on you, and then it doesn't give you any moments of relief, and then at the end it goes, oh well, it didn't work out for anyone really. Bye. Yeah. Quite good at
it
that.
It works out for the cool.
Yeah, well, but as I say, for me, it doesn't feel entirely sure whether it does or not, because they don't look happy about it. So whether they're going to get their riches or not, I do not know. Ambiguous for me.
I would possibly suggest that one of the kings of hell would renege on a promise. If there's anything about the rulers of hell, is that the trustworthy, honest bunch.
Of course, yes, sir. I apologize to the rulers of hell. I shouldn't have suggested that you were anything but
upstanding citizens.
Upstanding, friendly, honest citizens. And I salute you, really. Except I don't. Well, there you go. Well, yeah. I think I'm almost done for notes, really. So, have you got more?
No, I mean, to be honest, if it was, like, if we could be talking about this for quite a while longer for me, but it would just devolve into me going, remember that bit, and I don't think anyone wants to listen to that. So I'm probably going to walk away. While I'm ahead, I think.
For you, James, anything else you want to say before I hit the Facebook group?
I think the only thing I want to mention is that it's fascinating how this horrific thing that's happening to this family, this outside force that's tearing them apart, how it's essentially dredging up these deep-seated issues that they've tried burying. I mean, there's the mention of how Annie was sleepwalking one night and she awoke as she was about to burn her children alive, which is just the kind of thing you think, wait, what? But, and surely is a major thing for the family, but it seems like they're trying to move forward, essentially, trying to get past that. And it just feels really odd. It just feels like they have issues which all this is just bringing to the forefront.
Yeah.
And the bit which really sticks in my mind is the dream where Annie's admitting to Peter about she tried to have a miscarriage. And the way it plays out, it feels as though these dark truths she's tried suppressing are just bursting out of her mouth, like she's projectile truth-telling. And it just feels like we're watching somebody pick at a wound and just bring all this forward to show that the curse didn't fuck up the family. The rot seeped in long before that.
But at the same time, as against that, the reason that she didn't is because of how messed up her family was because of the generation before her, which is, again, you know, it gives that the film its title, doesn't it? Those are the problems that are passed down, and like it's that argument about, you know, the free will, isn't it? And is she doomed to this because of her upbringing and what's happened to her before, or is, you know, are they just I don't know, say weak willed, you know, for want of a better word there.
It's a very interesting movie. A lot of interpretations, I think, that are worth looking at. Probably watch it again at some point, I imagine. Maybe we'll do a Hereditary 2 episode. Not for a sequel, I don't mean. Although I would watch a sequel to this, but it'd have to be something completely different in tone. I would see Paimon trying to get through high school. That's what I want.
Your goofball comedy about the King of Hell trying to get laid.
Yeah. That's what I want. Yeah.
The King of Hell's met his match. High school life.
There you go. See? Perfect. You've done it. Well done.
Rami, let's be completely honest. If you went to high school and were trying to claim that you were the King of Hell, you would get the shit ripped out of you, wouldn't you? Like, no, nobody is taking you seriously in that situation.
Yeah, very true.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let's have it too. Hereditary 2, school's out, whatever. Yeah, we'll do it. If you're listening, Ari Aster, make it. And I know you're not. Well, let me go over to the Facebook group then. And have a look and see what they've said. Let's see if our lovely listeners can surmise in seconds what we took as ages. So Matt Crawley said, for me, it's possibly the best horror film of the last decade. Yeah, I'd echo that, actually.
For me, it is.
Yeah. For one of the best horrors of all... Oh, sorry, Brian. One of the best horrors of all time. It feels both new and traditional, and the attention to detail to make this work is second to none. Peter.
Agreed.
Yeah. One of those cases
smart
where...
Smart bunch this lot.
Very much so. Peter said, one of those cases where a horror really matches up to its hype. Superbly marketed. You go in expecting it to be a story about a haunted little girl, and that gets pulled from you, under you, in epic fashion. When it ends up being one of the most complex family dramas ever made, but with a massive dollop of a cult as well. Incredible acting all round as well. That just elevates it above and beyond. Hail Paimon. Yeah, very good. It was written more eloquently than I said it, but let's see. Vanessa enjoyed it enough, but felt it fell away a bit at the end. Not one I'd watch again in a hurry, although some very effective scenes.
Well, Vanessa, I hope our comments about how much you get out of it a second time may have changed your mind.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
You never know.
Yeah. Tammy said, watched it at the cinema, bought the DVD when it came out. DVD is still in the packaging because I'm not sure I can handle watching it again. I will, though. That's a good one. Let's see. The king of the podcast, Alistair. It's equally underrated. No, it's equally overrated and underrated. People want to say it's the best horror movie ever. It's not. People in response want to say it's trash. It's not. It's very well made horror that, although didn't start the trend, is the archetype of elevated horror. Also, give Toni Collette more roles and awards. She fucking rules all the time, every time. Well, I agree.
Agreed.
Certainly agree with the Toni Collette thing. Matt, for a second time, said Collette should have got an Oscar nomination for it, but it's horror, so of course not. And Chloe said, literally incredible. I'd say, yeah, again, the Facebook group have managed to eloquently write some lovely things there. Not eloquently said, because I'm rubbish at reading things. But still, yeah, it is actually quite a divisive movie, though. I mean, a lot of people I know like it, but if you go onto horror groups and stuff like that, there's a lot of people who say they just don't like it at all. I suppose it is something different from if you're sort of a traditional horror fan. It's not really in that vein, is it? So I can understand why people don't get on board with it.
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be people that like and dislike stuff.
And although
I will disagree with anyone who doesn't like this film. And I will try to convince them otherwise. I mean, what are you going to do at the end of the day? I can still enjoy it.
Exactly. Or someone else's opinion doesn't ruin your opinion of a film. It's a good attitude. It's a good internet attitude, that. Right, well, let's get into the second slice of bread. But before we do, let's talk about the social medias. You can join them, of course. Facebook is the place that we ask people their opinions on the films we're going to be doing. I'm going to be posting that more on Instagram as well now, because apparently Facebook's really for old people, apparently. So that's what I've heard anyway.
I would have wanted to cast this film because I don't know how old our audience skews.
Yeah, well, I don't know either, but I'm going to start asking people on the Instagram as well. So anyway, those are available to you if you'd like to join them and find out what we're on with. If you do listen to the podcast, give it a 5-star review wherever. Hopefully you do listen to it. But if you haven't given us a 5-star review, you can. And if you haven't written a review, please do. While we're here as well, I think we'll plug James's thing. So you've got a blog, right? A movie
Yeah,
blog.
So I regularly write reviews, and they can be found at thereviewingrodders.co.uk. That's spelt with 2 Ds. I'm also a regular writer at nerdly.co.uk, and I write reviews for them. Should I plug my social medias while I'm here?
Yeah, go for it. Everything you want.
Whatever you
want
to
look at, yeah.
Okay, I'm on Letterboxd, Twitter, until Elon fucks it over even more. I'm everywhere at RoddersJ04, again, with 2 Ds. So, yeah, come check me out if I've not put you off following me or anything.
Lovely. Do that. I was reading a bit of your blog today. There was a movie on there. There was a movie on there that you've seen that I didn't know was out, or I don't know if you got special. What is it? The spider one. Sting.
Yes, I did. That's not out yet. I did get to screener access for it.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. Wish we could get screener access for things. Oh, well. Yeah, because I've been looking forward to seeing Sting, in fact. Don't ruin it for me, because it probably isn't that good. Right, so let's get into the second slice of bread and ask you these last questions. So what is the worst horror movie you've seen?
I'm going to go with a film by Uthbe Boll, and that's Seed. It's inept is the best way I can describe it. It's a serial killer film that wants to show how sick he is by having him watch real life footage of animal killings. And it has a 5-minute sequence where he kills a woman with a chisel, and it's the most boring thing I've seen in a while. It's Uwe Boll, hit hot take, not a good filmmaker. And Seed is the worst thing I've seen of his. Have you guys seen any Uwe Boll films?
I will remain entirely silent on Uwe Boll because I know what he does to people who criticize him. And that is trick them into hosting a charity boxing match and then beat the shit out of them. So I will not be saying anything bad about Uwe Boll.
Yeah.
But that is not a quality of his filmmaking, because you may or may not be correct.
Oh dear. Unwilling to comment. I haven't seen any of his films. I was just looking at the thing there. But this Seed movie doesn't look very good. So yeah.
No.
But it's not, it's rubbish, and Uwe Boll's a shit filmmaker.
Oh no.
But I didn't say that, someone else did.
Oh, you were just reading that off somewhere. Yeah. No, fair enough. All comments were read off.
Guy Shuri Pummel said it.
Yeah, don't pummel him again though, eh?
You can't hit someone enough to make him think Uwe Boll makes good films.
Get that on a t-shirt.
I don't know. I kind of think that Uwe Boll targets an audience of people who have brain damage. That's cruel, isn't it? I shouldn't say that. I'm cancelled for saying things like that.
Well, you said it now. I can delete it.
I
could delete it in the edit if you don't want to sign up to that. but I won't. Right. So, what is your favorite horror movie?
The full 180 on quality from Seed is John Carpenter's classic Halloween. I watch it for the first time in, I want to say, 2011, and I've just watched it every October 31st ever since. I just think the way it uses shadows and slow tracking shots just unnerve me and builds in the way it builds tension. I just think it's one of the greatest films I've ever seen, and I absolutely love it. The rest of the franchise is another story, but I love Halloween.
Oh, I'm impressed that you watched it so late and it held up so much for you. That's pretty good. That's pretty good going for Halloween.
I also did watch it relatively recently as well, and can confirm it does still hold up as well.
Look at you both go.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look at John Carpenter go, really.
I suppose.
He's the one we need to thank.
He's good, isn't he, John Carpenter? Does some great stuff. What a lovely, rich film history he's got. I think we've only done two John Carpenters on here. Well, one. Two?
We've done Christine, and I wasn't here for him. We did They Live as well.
Well, we did do Christine, yeah.
Oh, those are two good ones.
Yeah, so None of the, well, I suppose They Live is a big hitter. Not really a horror film, though. I'm sticking with that. Right, well, yeah, Halloween. Well, you can't knock it, I suppose.
You know, I'm surprised that we've not had that more as an answer, because it is such a classic, and for such good reason. I thought we would have, yeah, heard that a few more times.
Yeah, that's true. Although it didn't make it into either of our top 10 rankings, did it? I don't think. Or did it?
No. More fool us, I suppose, because it is really bloody good.
Weird. Right, so what is a scary moment from a non-horror movie that you remember?
Well, I was racking my brains because everything I thought of just made me go, wait, that is a horror film. And my ultimate answer is in Pan's Labyrinth, I went with the Pale Man sequence.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Mm.
Although I'd probably go and say that is a horror film.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, you're right. That dude's scary as hell. Eyes in weird places. Eyes in weird places. Just keep your eyes on
how
your
do you
head.
Keep them clean?
I don't know. I don't know. I'll keep my current eyes clean.
Self-cleaning.
They are, aren't they? Tears. Mm-hmm. Well, there you go then. That's the answer to that. That's how you keep them clean. They're self-cleaning. Or windoline. I don't know.
Crying's good for you then.
Yeah. There you go, everyone. Crying's good for you. Get yourself some trauma. And then you'll have lovely clean eyes. I don't know, maybe. So if you could make any non-horror movie or horror movie, what would you choose?
So the first one that came to mind was the Adam Sandler film 50 First Dates.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the whole idea of just a woman waking up and being told that, oh, this absolute stranger, the one who you have no memory of, he's your boyfriend, you have a whole history, and you may not remember it happening, but it did happen. And also, as the end of that film suggests, you had a kid or two. Go through. And it's just the kind of thing of recontextualizing a silly 2000s comedy from another angle. That just sounds like it could work as a horror film, really.
Yeah, absolutely could. I feel like it fits into some of those current trends that we're getting, where they taking those sort of comedy movies and turning them into horror.
I mean, waking up next to Adam Sandler for the rest of your life would be terrifying enough as it is, wouldn't it?
Well, not if you don't remember him.
Well, I was thinking we just need to cast Adam Sandler in it again. He's already the perfect casting.
You could make that a really awful film. And have someone, you know, the person just be tortured relentlessly and then not remember it the next day.
Oh, God.
You know, like absolute mental torture. Maybe not so much physical torture, a little bit, but. You know, absolute mental torture on a day-out-day basis. What an awful thing to do to somebody. Yeah. That movie could rule. Or also be really disturbing. Okay, let's make it. We know a filmmaker. Let's game on it. We'll get a shoestring budget and away we'll go.
Ooh, sweet, sweet executive producer credit.
Yeah, we could, yeah. Yeah. Or, I want to be the best boy. I don't really know what they do. I think they just help the guy with the lights. I want to do that.
Was it Val Kilmer says at the end of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang? If you want to know who the best boy is, it's somebody's cousin.
There you go. You see, I could be the best boy, the bestest of boys. Lovely. So yeah, we're going to get on that. We're going to make 50 first tortures,
deaths,
50 no. first deaths, 51st death, something like that. We'll brainstorm that. We'll brainstorm that and get back to you. Lovely. So, well, that brings us to the end then. We've done it. We've achieved another podcast.
Hooray.
I like that. Hooray. It was Muppet-like. Well done, you. Yeah, let's go, because I don't know how to end this. You've got your sandwich, you know, so let's say bye, everyone. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, and watch out for telephone poles.
Oh, yeah.
Why? Why do you have to remind us?
I have to remember it, so do you.